it's all eyes.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is L.A. Williams, and this weekend, Sean and I are interviewing the star of Episode 5, Season 2 of I Was a Teenage Felon, Peter Meyerhoff, a.k.a. Chappie.
My judge, he was known for just giving too harsh a sentence, so I got 12 years in prison for a non-dangerous theft charge. I had 10 co-defendants. Everybody else got jail and probation. I got 12 years in prison.
So tell us about being a shot caller in prison.
I was at lunch just talking about this right now. You know, it's something I work on daily because in prison, you know, if I don't care if it's sunny out and I told you it's cloudy, you're going to agree with me and say it's cloudy or else.
So what's different on the outside?
The respect is probably the biggest thing. You know, people are just disrespectful and rude out here, you know, and like someone will cut me off at the gas station or anything like that. And I just have to just tell myself, man, it is what it is. You know,
forgive these people for they have no idea.
Better listen close to this one. Absolutely. Ladies and gentlemen, what's happening? It's your man, L.A. Williams, the Blind Master. And who do I have across from me but the one and only Mr. Sean V. Bradley? What's going on, Sean?
Yo, my dude, how many times I got to tell you, you need to address me as the TV star, Sean V. Bradley,
superstar.
CSP. I'm about to be a damn TV star, man. Season finale style, L.A. Williams, man. I'm doing great.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about, man. Phenomenal stuff, man. Yeah, this I Was a Teenage Felon thing is creeping up on us. You know what I'm saying? It's like less than 2 weeks. You know what I'm saying? It's less than 2 weeks. It's about to go down.
It's pretty much like a week away. This is Saturday.
Days.
It's a Saturday before the last Saturday before it exposes. So, yeah, we're probably about like what is it, 8 or 9 days away from the season finale. Mm-hmm. And, man, my inbox is blowing up, you know, from a lot of people that are coming to the premiere and that are just like they're watching these episodes like, you know, that are going on because season two is in the middle.
Yeah.
And I got to tell you, man, one of my favorite episodes from season two, because I'm prejudiced. All right. Yo. I'm, you know why? I'm prejudiced of non-car people. You know what I mean? Like I'm a car guy.
Right.
And when I found out that episode 5 was of a real, not only one car guy, but two car guys, somebody that became an F&I manager and crushed it on the West Coast, you know I had to reach out and try to connect with them and see what's up. So, L.A., why don't you tell the people what we're going to have after the break, man? It's deep.
Well, you know what's crazy about this is, you know, Sean, I am usually like the big researcher before we do any of these radio shows and everything like that. But this time I'm being caught slipping, right? So I know who it is and everything, but normally I kind of check out the episodes and everything beforehand. So give me a quick little synopsis. I know I'm getting ready to learn all the details, but give me like a 10-second
Yo,
synopsis.
All I'm going to say is this, is that episode 5 is called Shot Caller. You know what I mean? So unless you've never seen Lock Up Raw or like, you know, Blood In, Blood Out, if you don't know what a shot caller is, then you need to be smacked. You're from North Philly. You're from the hood. Best know what
right,
a shot
man.
Caller
is. I totally know what a shot caller is. And listen, we got a shot caller, man. This guy, Peter Meyerhoff, is absolutely amazing. It's Against All Eyes. We'll be right back.
Vice TV presents
I Was a Teenage Felon
Season 2 starring Sean V. Bradley.
He's the king of clubs.
At 19 years old, part of a multi-million dollar international drug ring. Arrested by the Secret Service, DEA.
This was the largest ecstasy case in United States history.
And somehow this dude becomes a best-selling author and a mega millionaire when he gets out of prison.
Find out how only on Vice TV's I Was a Teenage Felon, Mondays at 10 p.m.
Exclusively on Vice TV.
Did you know that Car.com is a website to connect consumers like you, me, our parents, basically everybody to local car dealers? Car.com helps us find that perfect vehicle. From new vehicles to certified pre-owned, Car.com will help you find the best vehicle match. Car.com practically started the online car shopping experience. Peace of mind and finding your perfect vehicle, it's what they do. Car.com, we do the research, you do the driving. Get started getting that peace of mind today at Car.com.
Yo, this is your host, Sean V. Bradley. And I know you hear me every week on this radio show, but did you know that I'm the star of Vice TV's hit show, I Was a Teenage Felon, Season 2? It airs every Monday at 10 p.m. So make sure you check out my show, I Was a Teenage Felon, on Vice TV.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are back on the Against All Odds radio show. And of course, we got Sean V. Bradley in the building. But we have the star of Episode 5, Season 2 of Vice TV's I Was a Teenage Felon, my man, Mr. Peter Meyerhoff. What's going on, Peter? Appreciate you being on the show.
Man, how are you? Thanks for having me. I'm excited.
Yeah, man, this is going to be cool because I got some car guys, man. We some car guys having a conversation today. Now,
wait. Let's just go into this really quick. First of all, my man, thank you for coming to the show and just kind of sharing your experience. I got so much I want to talk to you about, like LA said, about the car guy angle. But first of all, congratulations, man, because I know your story. And for you to go through what you went through as much time as you did and now have changed your life around and are currently in the middle of Season 2 of Vice's I Was a Teenage Felon, you deserve kudos. You deserve much respect because it's not easy to, first of all, not reoffend and get violated and go back to prison, but it's even harder to make something really profound and successful. So I want to just acknowledge your accomplishments right there, Peter. Congratulations, brother.
Congratulations.
Thank you, man. Seriously. I really appreciate it. It ain't easy, but anybody can do it.
Well said. So let's kind of go into this. Before we find out the details, I want to know, like, what is that like to have just recently, a couple weeks ago, aired internationally on Vice TV in front of God knows how many millions of people, you know, between the TV show, the live streaming services and all that stuff. What's that like for you to have that experience?
It's humbling. It's beyond cool. I mean, I knew I was going to be on TV the whole time and I'm waiting for it, you know, and then watching the first week, you know, with my family right there, you know, my mom, the wife, everybody, like, it felt like everything I had, all the prison time I did and all the bad stuff I did, like, came to this moment to, like, where, like, the tides had turned, you know, and now I'm on, like, because not only did I want to be successful when I got out of prison and not reoffend, but, like, to be on national TV, to, like, come full circle, you know what I'm saying?
No, brother, international TV. This is big in Europe, you know what I mean? Like, it was actually first in Europe, in London, in the UK, so you're global right now. Like
it's crazy, and every commercial break, I was like, I can't believe that was me, you know what I mean? It's crazy, bro.
Yeah, no, and that's the other thing is that you were really lucky because they used, you know, some of your stuff in the entire promo for the entire preseason and season and stuff like that. So tell us, first of all, like, before you get into the story, just how did you get hooked up with Vice and how did Vice wind up signing you to the show?
Instagram. And it could have been, I think, from Big Herc, who's a mutual friend that we have from Fresh Out series, because he was on season one. And one of the producers had reached out to me and wanted to hear kind of more about my story. I remember the final instances. It was between me and some other woman who had a really big YouTube following, social media following, and all that stuff. And I didn't. I was still kind of learning that you can make a living with social media and all this stuff. And I was just working my ass off at the car dealership, you know. And once I saw it was kind of between me and her, I'm not gonna lie, I was like, "There's no way they're gonna give this to me," you know, just because she had a huge following, has a huge YouTube channel. And I want to say it was like 2 days later that the producer hit me back. He's like, "Yo, they want to roll with your show." And he's like, "They're fired up about it." I was like, "No way." And then you don't even know how big it is, bro, until you see like how much money they put into this stuff, you know, and they rent out this building in downtown Phoenix for a whole week and like flew my family out here and like brought back another time with like 7 producers and for a whole week just to go to film all the different locations from my crime and, you know, seeing my high school on TV. And I only completed 3 months of high school, you know, I can't even say completed, but I only attended 3 months of high school. And it's surreal and humbling, but it also makes everything I do nowadays a lot easier to do, you know, when you see your work getting noticed.
Yeah. To your point, the amount, like, people don't realize, I didn't even realize, and I've been in the entertainment industry, but on the music side, I was never really into like TV or film. And it's kind of mind blowing, like, the scouts. So they have scout producers that basically kind of vet you. And then once IDP, the production company, you know, goes to Vice and they think that you'll be a go, the scout producers got to kind of put together a synopsis of who you are and what they think the episode will be like. And then once that gets approved, it goes into the pre-production, you know, producer, and they've got to turn around and put the whole story together, create the treatment, the timeline. Then they've got to put the co-stars. They've got to have all that stuff, the shooting. And then from there, that's where I think it really gets crazy, when they do all the reenactments, all the technology and all that stuff to make the story sensational. Yeah, man, there's a tremendous amount of money that the network puts through. And, you know, I think it's amazing. And here's one, I want to get your opinion on this. The amount of money that they put in to this, what I thought about being on the show is that I was like, man, if they're putting this much money into it, I don't want to miss the opportunity. I want to try to do whatever I can to promote and to not ride, but to ride the exposure that this major TV network is doing. Is that what your strategy was? Is that, man, if Vice is going to put all this time and money into it, I want to leverage my exposure on the show to be able to build my new brand or get speaking gigs or whatever. So what were you hoping to get from all this crazy TV exposure from Vice?
To be honest, in the very beginning, I just wanted to be on TV. I thought it was awesome. And I'm not gonna lie, I just wanted to be on TV. I was like, you don't have me on Vice TV yet. Let's do it. You know, and then there was quite a bit of time from when they actually did all the filming and stuff out here. So it was actually going to air. It was close to a year. I mean, we filmed mine, I think 10 months ago. But I honestly was like kind of trapped where I was, you know? So I thought it was cool and I wanted to be on TV. And then as the time was going, I'm like I said, I've only been out 6 years. So I'm still learning how society works and how social right. media works and all that stuff. It was a kind of in my head. I was like, man, and all I thought to myself was, I'm going to waste all this time and stuff I did with Vice and it's going to go for nothing, you know? So it kind of led me to what we'll get to later, which is my final career choice, which made me walk away from my job, because probably one of the final straws was I needed to do some of this Vice thing, you know? So I decided to walk away right before my show aired to try and build some traction and stuff, because I want to get my message out there. You know, I want to help people. And that's what I'm all about nowadays.
No, I respect that. So tell me about like your family, like, you know, because I watched your episode and yo, man, it was crazy having like your dad, you know, getting, you know, choked up talking about stuff and your family that was there. What was it like for them to hear that you got signed to season two of Vice and they were going to tell, like, you know, and it's almost impossible to pack your entire life into just 1 hour. And after commercials, 44 minutes. But the fact that they did an entire episode on you and your story, what was that like for your family?
Finally, tears, but the good kind, you know. I felt like my whole life I had just been hurting them, you know, and we always cried for not good stuff, you know. And this is, like I said, I wanted to get on TV, but by the time it came around, I was just happy to finally like do positive stuff, you know, and finally have my mom and dad proud of me, you know, and finally have my brother like be proud to call me his brother, you know, instead of always having to cover for me for all the bad stuff I'd done or whatever. So it was really the coolest moment about it was just knowing that, like I said, I'd finally made that leap and I'd done something positive and like my family like supported me. And I felt like that was probably the best feeling about the whole thing, you know?
Yeah. And I got to say this, since you kind of like brought some of this up, I was surprised, but respect and I'm impressed with how like sincere you were, because again, shot caller gives, like, you know, I've been in you know, some serious facilities my damn self. And again, a shot caller is reserved for a certain caliber of individual. And the fact that you were able to be vulnerable and show your emotions, you know, it humanized you, you know, I mean, especially when having some serious charges that you have. Was that hard for you? You know what I mean? Because you have, you know, people have an image of being, you know, gangster, being tough, or being a freaking shot caller, you know, especially to, you know, did you think about that? You know, like, I'm going to consciously, you know, just be very genuine and be very transparent and emotional, or, you know, or did you kind of regret that you were kind of just vulnerable in the episode?
Not at all. You know, fake tough guys aren't vulnerable. You know what I mean? Real tough guys are comfortable in themselves. Yeah. I'm always comfortable myself. I'll probably cry before we get done this episode. And I'm not gonna lie, I might cry more than one time, you know? And I've been doing a lot of crying lately. You know, I cried in my truck driving this morning to the gym. You know, I've only been out 6 years, you know, and I still drive and hear a song that takes me back and I just cry. And I'm like, I cannot believe this is my life now. You know, I never thought I was going to make it out of there. And I'm just an alpha male, you know? So I became a shot caller in there because I never thought I was going to get out, you know, but it's just, it goes to kind of what I talk about now. you can train your brain to do anything. You know, I was the last dude in the world that should ever been a shot caller in prison, but I'm an alpha male. I learned how to figure stuff out. Luckily, I used to box, so that works out for you pretty well.
Here's the thing, though, is that, like, again, we really know the reality is that people that go to prison on that tough guy rah-rah stuff is usually the person that's being sold for a pack of Newports. You know what I mean? Like,
you're absolutely right.
You know what I mean? So I don't think that there's anything wrong, like, you know, the people that are comfortable with their own emotions. And if you are secure with you, you could be very transparent. And again, you're not on the yard where it's not good to be able to show weakness or
I was like, known for crying on the yard.
Yeah, there you go. That's crazy.
I'm serious. Like, if Titanic came on or Armageddon, I'm not joking. I will still cry to this day. And people knew me on the yard for that. I have never had shame in who I am.
Yo, I love it. Yo, you know what I'm saying? This is interesting as hell. Like, I love it too. I love that you were that real, that you were secure in your own. And that's the thing that really impressed me, was like, not just you, but like just your dad's raw emotion, you know, your family's emotion, just telling the story. Because you know how it is on TV. I don't know about you, but Vice tried to turn around and tell me to say this and say that. And I told him, I said, like, I ain't embellishing on because my word is my bond, and I'm, because it's TV and they want to be able to sensationalize stuff. And I'm like, nah, fam, we're not going there. Like, we're only sticking to the facts and stuff like that. So some people, and if you read the comments on YouTube for people that watch the episodes, not your episode, but like other episodes from season one, they can say, man, that's not real, whatever. But I can see the authenticity in your interview. You know what I mean? Like the emotion from you and your family, unless you guys need to be like, you know, getting an Academy Award for some, like, you know, it seemed very authentic. So I want to just commend you and say, first of all, just as a man, you don't really see that. And then someone that's been through the amount of like real serious stuff that you have, I just thought that was very unique. And I have a lot of respect for you for that, honestly.
Thank you, man. And yeah, and I just, goes with anything in life, like what I'm doing now, and just like prison, you know, I try to make the best of any situation. And in there, the top of the food chain is the shot caller, you know. And there ain't a, and I always say this, I'm not proud of it now, but there ain't a bad prison or a max yard or a super max facility that I haven't been in out here and ran, and it, and I thought it was cool, and that's what I strive for, you know. And in prison, that's all I want to do, is be tough and bad, and then out here, you get out here and it doesn't make you any money. You know,
not at all.
And you have them to rewire your entire brain.
Your stripes that you had in prison don't like correlate to this, to civilian life. I agree. So let's get into this a little bit. So, okay, I hope that our audience is listening to this on the radio thing, like, damn, I gotta hear, what did he do? So kind of talk us through for the, you know, before we go to break and then probably into the next segment here, just a little bit about like, why the hell would a major TV show care about what you did? You must have did something sensational to be able to get Vice's attention. So what was it that captivated these producers to make you the star of your own episode?
I honestly think it was probably because my sentencing, like, my judge is gone to this day from, he was known for just giving too harsh a sentence. So I got 12 years in prison for a non-dangerous theft charge. Never, no weapons, no guns, no nothing like that. And yeah, non-dangerous theft charge, 12 years in prison. I had 10 co-defendants. The only other one got 2.5 years. Everybody else got jail and probation. I got 12 years in prison.
And weren't you, if I remember the episode correctly, weren't you thinking that you might do 4 years or something like that? Or tell us that part. What the hell happened that you got 12? Like, that's crazy.
Yeah. So that's I had signed a plea bargain initially for four to 6.5 years. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't going to sign that, but they had since then charged my mom, my dad, and my grandma with my crimes. Who, my grandma's living with my mom's house. I was still a kid, you know, I was living in my parents' house, and I had stuff at both houses. So they ended up charging them just because I wouldn't sign a plea bargain. So finally I was in the county jail fighting my case for almost 2 years, you know, and you know, that's rough in the county jail.
Yes.
And so I didn't go to prison until I was 20, but I got locked up right at 18. And the final settlement conference, I told them I'll sign the plea bargain, just drop the charges against my family. And they did that. I signed the plea bargain. The prosecutor said she would recommend the minimum. So it could have been, I think, a super mitigated, like 3.5 years, but up to 6.5. And I remember verbatim telling my lawyer right before that, I can't do no freaking 6 years. Do not give me 6 years, you know?
Right.
And went in for my sentencing. The prosecutor went back on her word, but a settlement conference is one of the only court hearings that's not with a court reporter in it, because it's a private mediation with you, the judge, and the lawyer, and the judge is a different lawyer. So now I'm back in front of my lawyer, and the prosecutor asked for 13 years. And I remember like it was yesterday, the judge, his final words to me is, I think this calls for an aggravated sentence of 12 years. So I go from getting 4 years and I'm out in a year because I got 2 years back time to
wait a minute. So even though that they agreed to this 6.5 years, didn't you say, well, wait a minute, I was promised only this. Did you blurt that out in court? Did you?
No, because I signed an open-ended plea because she told me not on the microphone that she would recommend the minimum. So I'm like, okay, cool. I'll do that. I'll do the 4 years, whatever, hopefully get 3.5 or something. And then by that time, it's literally just too late. It was my sentencing. She asked for 13. I mean, but the judge says 12 years. I can't go, yo, it gets even worse than that. When I go to prison 6 months later, they bring up the charge against all my family again.
No.
Oh, my mom and dad and grandma had to go to felony trial. My dad still to this day got found guilty of a misdemeanor of like knowingly possessing stolen property. And he's never been arrested for anything in his life. My story is as crazy as you.
No, so talk me through this. Like being, you were said 20 years old when you took the plea, right?
Yeah, 19 or 20. Yeah, probably 19 or 20 years old. Sorry.
So what's that like when you are 20 years old? And I'm sorry to like ask like hard questions, but I'm just curious. Oh. What was that like being that young age, like a young adult, you know, and almost getting the amount of time that you're alive? Just, yeah, that you're there, like you're 12 years. That's more than 2/3 of your life right there.
Only you say that because that's the only way I could ever compare it to time. All I remember thinking is 12 years. I was like, geez, I remember how long it took me to get to 18 years old. And that's how I could do my time. I'm like, I have to do almost all that time because I did the math. I was like, I didn't really remember stuff when I was 5 years old. So I pretty much had my whole life that I had done with memory. And now I have to do that in prison. If I get out and I behave and I make it out alive, you know, I'm not knowing I can be a shot caller. I'm like still scared of going to prison at this time.
Right. So then what was that like when that reality hit? Did that hit you at sentencing or after you were back in your cell? Like, when did it hit you? Like, oh my God, this is crazy.
It hit me right at sentencing. I remember because I was bawling before I was talking. I'm sympathetic, you know, like I don't like the stuff I did. I'm not proud of anything bad I've done. That's why I'm on my mission right now to try to right all my wrongs and help.
So you broke down at sentencing right there?
Oh, when I was crying, you know, I have a crazy story. If you watch any of my stuff, you'll know like my victim, I knew, and we used to have a friendship together, and it's a crazy long story. So I felt bad for them. You know, right when I got locked up, I wrote them apology letters without trying to tell the courts, just from my own heart, you know? And once I got off the drugs, I realized it. And the second I got sentenced, I went from crying to just shock, and I stopped crying. And I remember just like, you are kidding me. What am I going to do? And I was almost too shocked, you know, and it was just kind of blurry. And the next thing, I kind of feel like I blacked out or something. Cause the next thing I remember is just getting back to the jail. Cause you know, transport goes in here where you got a court date. You don't make it back till 5 o'clock at night usually. And then I got a phone call and I just remember calling my little brother and we probably got two words out the whole 15-minute phone call. And we're just crying. And all he kept saying is he's going to visit me every weekend. And I remember just saying, sorry, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's absolutely
crazy. My brother always looked up to me, you know, and I was just gone. I felt like I'm just gone for the rest of his life.
Damn. No, I totally understand where you're coming from, man.
Okay, I was going to cry.
We definitely got to get a little bit more of this story, man. We'll be right back, yo. Against All Odds is on your radio.
Vice TV presents
I Was a Teenage Felon,
Season 2, starring Sean V. Bradley.
He's the king of clubs.
At 19 years old, part of a multi-million-dollar international drug ring. Arrested by the Secret Service, DEA.
This was the largest ecstasy case in United States history.
And somehow this dude becomes a best-selling author and a mega millionaire when he gets out of prison.
Find out how only on Vice TV's I Was a Teenage Felon, Mondays at 10 p.m.
Exclusively on Vice TV.
From nothing to everything.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are back on the Against All Odds radio show. And man, I'm telling you, stuff was starting to get emotional right before we hit the break. So, man, Peter, I love it, man. I love how vulnerable you can be telling us the story and, you know, going to jail and talking to your brother and everything like that. But it just sounds kind of scrambly. Can you put a timeline to it? Kind of break down for us how everything seemed to happen so fast from whenever this whole thing first started all the way up until you went to prison. Break that down for
us. Gladly. You know, so I had it all as a kid. I used to model. I had a modeling agent when I was, I think, 12 or 13 years old. I was in a movie as a kid.
What movie?
You know, it's crazy. I never even got the title to the movie. It was a Japanese baseball documentary, but Hideo Nomo was in it when he just came over here to America to play baseball. So I got to hit off him when I was a kid. Oh, and wow. Yeah. And I was an athlete, football, baseball, used to box. I mean, I had it all. I thought I was just going to have my pick of what sport I wanted to go pro at. Popular kid where I'm from in Ahwatukee, and just drinking and partying, doing my normal thing. When I get to high school, I start hanging out with all the older kids. So we're drinking and partying. And one night, me and my best friend, to tell you my story, it'll come full circle, who's the guy I ended up burglarizing his house to go to prison for. Me and him went to just do our thing at 15 years old, hook up with chicks in high school, just like everybody else does when they're kids. We do it two nights in a row, Friday night, me, him, two girls, the same exact thing, and her older brother dropped her off because we weren't even driving yet. The same night happens again on a Saturday night. To this day, I think she got caught sneaking into her mom's house or something. I don't even know what it was, but she happens to say that I had sex with her while she was sleeping and ruined my life. Overnight, I went from being the most popular kid, the star athlete, to the next day, I couldn't go to school. I wasn't safe. She went to school bragging about it, but didn't want to press charges and wouldn't take a lie detector test. And all my friends.
How old were you?
I was 15 years old.
Okay, so you were 15 years old, and some girl accuses you of rape when she was sleeping.
Yeah, and we had, and this was the second night we had sex. We had sex Friday night too, and I lost my virginity to her. And then Saturday night we did the same exact thing.
So now, were there ever any charges filed against you?
Nope.
So wait a minute. So the police were
police. All they did was ask me if I would take a lie detector test and told her what had happened. They did like a whatever rape kit on her, and it saw that she had sex, but nothing was damaged, so nothing was forced. I agreed to take a lie detector test. She wouldn't take a lie detector test. Nothing came about it. But however, she went to school bragging about it.
So did you take a lie detector test or no?
No, they never even made it because she wouldn't take one.
Okay. And so basically this young woman spread some craziness out there with no proof, no anything.
Nothing at all.
So this kind of must have, I can imagine this must have like really ruined a young man's life that was really into, you know, sports and you're popular and that. And you said overnight it changed
Okay. And I went from being the most popular kid. Yeah, sorry. I went from being the most popular kid in all the schools to I wasn't safe to go to school. Like literally, like they were kids. It turned into a thing where they were coming by and like carloads of people and damaging my parents' houses, like throwing boulders through their windows. Like every single one of my friends turned on me. And coming full circle, the guy whose house ended up burglarizing was my best friend at the time, who was there and knew exactly what happened. And kind of the reason I went and burglarized his house, because he didn't stand up for me. All he has to do is stand up and say he knew what happened. It all goes away.
But why didn't he stand up
to this day? Kids are so, the only thing, and trust me, I spent years and years racking my brain on this. Kids are just easily impressionable. It's kind of why I'm choosing to be transparent about it, because I don't even like saying the word rape. It grosses me out. Like, and it's very tricky, but I want to be super transparent because it does happen and people don't want to talk about it. And if people just don't go with the crowd and make their own judgments or actually just stand up against what's being said, my life, it doesn't send me to prison. All he has to do is say he knew what happened. He was there. She planned on coming over and hooking up with me. We did the same thing Friday night.
Right.
And it's still to this day, I didn't get how he didn't do it.
So what you're saying is that this is the one. So we don't know the whole story yet because it was on Vice, but not on our show yet. So tell us, like, you were robbing different places. And I believe that it was like over $1 million in high end. Talk to us about the story. Like what happened?
Yeah. So well over. So after that, I instantly had to drop out of school because I wasn't safe at school. So I go from hanging out with all the athletes and studs to hanging out with the dudes that did drugs and didn't go to school. So I instantly get turned on to drugs. I wasn't even involved with drugs before that. People that do drugs, steal and rob stuff. I just got into stealing stuff. I mean, I stole a Mercedes-Benz brand new from the Mercedes-Benz Chandler dealership, still had the plastic on the seats. And that's all we would do is go out and rob and steal stuff because I didn't have a care in the world. And I was mad at God. I was mad at how this possibly could have happened to my life. And I chose to numb my pain with drugs.
Damn. So you had over $1 million worth of jewelry. What type of stuff were you stealing? And tell us a little about that.
Literally everything from cars to houses. I mean, this one place, we got $330,000 worth of jewelry. I mean, they had Lamborghinis in the garage. Like they were set like that. And it was just nonstop, whatever it would be. We would just go out just jacking stuff all night long. That's kind of what we did with our time. And that's what that group of friends I got involved with did. And that's what I ended up doing. And I didn't even realize how bad it was until I was on my way to prison. I was like, what the heck did I get myself into?
Man, that's absolutely crazy. So you get locked up. You got played out on this, plea deal. You wind up doing 12 years. And once you get to prison, What was that like? Like, you know, when you hit the yard, what was your first thing going through your mind? And, you know, how did you turn around and start to function in prison role?
The first thing I said in was, how I'm going to do this. I remember my first walk on that yard, and I was thinking, this is the first time I ever felt like I was a nobody in life. I felt like the people couldn't even see me. You know, and I'm used to being the popular kid with all the attention. And I remember I was just a little scrawny ass kid. I was 160 pounds by the time I hit prison. And I remember walking there thinking, how am I going to do 12 years like this? You know, and that's all I could think about was, it feels like as long as I've been alive, you know, and it almost feels like a life sentence at 18 years old, you know. And luckily, when you know how to fight, you get a lot of attention in there. And I beat up a couple big dudes at first. One of the dudes, my first fight in prison was actually the dude running my building. It was twice my size. And I beat the
no
at him. He didn't even touch me. And once we get off lockdown for that, the next morning I come out to Chow, and all these OGs, you know, the dudes that didn't even notice me the day before were like, hey, youngster, I heard what you did. I heard what you did, this and that, you know. And I was like, all right, this is how I get some attention. So I kind of took and ran with it, you know, and I wanted to take my anger out on God and the world for having me in prison for 12 years. And it was just a perfect combination of bad stuff right there. And I took all my anger out on God and the world at everybody that I was in prison with, you know. And no one fought on yards with me more than me when I was on that yard. And I was an angry person. And that's what turned me into eventually being a shot caller, you know, because most of the shot callers can fight and are pretty angry dudes.
You know what? Let's talk about this for a second. And we just spoke about this, like, you know, off during break. But a lot of people don't understand how creative somebody has to be in prison. And I was sharing with you a story that, you know, when I was an ad seg in the feds and I wanted to smoke cigarettes or smoke whatever, you know what I mean? Like, I didn't have lighters. So we used to have to circulate the current. Yeah. I know that, you know, some people used to turn around and stick the wire into the outlet and then put it in to boil water. I want to just hear a couple MacGyver stories from you. Like, what did you do over your bid to be able to, like, you know, have some type of, like, whether it's coffee or smoking or whatever? Tell us some crazy convict ingenuity stories that you had a MacGyver in.
I mean, you could light a cigarette with just a couple pieces of lead. I don't know if you knew that. You'd take, and in the hole you'd take, and sometimes I would have to bite off the little tiny pencils and chew off all the wood all around the pencil till you get that final stick of lead. And then you break that in half, put that in the two electrical sockets. And then you take one of the other pieces on it and wrap it around with a little toilet paper thing, because you're not holding on to it. And you tap all those things on together and then get a little piece of toilet paper and it sparks. That's how you light your cigarettes, because you're not allowed to have lighters in the hole. So yeah, popping sockets. And there's so many little stingers, which is making little metal paper clips, and you tie those two together on just a cord. It could be from an old TV, and people don't know that you plug that in. That's how we got hot water in prison, because you don't get stingers in maximum security,
right?
Because you can throw boiling hot water on cops and inmates.
Exactly. So
that's how we heat our coffee up in Max.
All right. What about, because I know that you got a lot of ink too, because that was in the episode, and I see it on you, and I'm tattooed all over the place. Yeah. And so again, one of the things that we used to do is we used to take the tape recorders from the library, from the law library, and take the motors out. You get like the pen. And be able to have, like, you know, you can either get a needle, paper clip, you know, file it down, and used to make a tattoo gun.
For sure.
And yo, like, tattoo artists in prison live pretty damn well.
Yo,
so
yes.
Did your people used to make like tattoo guns and stuff like that?
Of course. For sure. Yeah. Okay. They'd make them out of little cassette players there, you know, and then you take the little Bic pen. And then a lot of people don't know how you get the needles in there. And it's from your little spring loaded pens that you steal from the cops.
Man, and listen, people used to buff like the ink, like the Indian ink for the tattoo stuff. Or we used to have to make with the shampoo, you know, and make, like, you know, like MacGyver ink.
Yeah,
I'm going to tell you a quick story here. So when I was, I learned a hustle when I was in jail. Like, I used to pop the phone lines. I was young and stupid when I was 19 years old. Like, I didn't care that they were recorded. I thought I was invincible. I was just an idiot when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. But I used to pop the phone lines and get credit card numbers. I would call, like, from three-way with my people in Brooklyn. And I'd say, listen, let's call Olive Garden or Sizzler or Ponderosa. And I go like this, like, ring. Can I speak to the manager? Manager gets on the phone. Hey, this is Detective Gagne at the Mercer County Sheriff's Department. I'm investigating serious robberies. We're trying to track down the houses that, you know, that these people broke in. We've got the credit card. The first number is a 4. And then I would get these people while I'm in prison to give me the entire number, the expiration date. I do a reverse lookup and I would basically get the address. And I wasn't buying them crazy. I would get flowers. Like I would buy, like I would charge like 25 cents on the dollar and I would get like 3 dozen roses, 4 dozen roses, or I would get like, you know, Vermont teddy bear, shit that wasn't going to get me crazy in trouble. And we would tell the people, listen, police are going to come to you. Just, you know, we didn't say, hey, this is from John from MDC Brooklyn Federal or Allenwood Penitentiary. We would say this is from your boo, or this is from your boy, or your, or whatever. And we never got caught, man. But I was making thousands of dollars a month, like thousands of dollars a month by just, you know, getting stuff to people out there. And with that money, I would have a store. You know what I mean? I would have people come through from commissary. And again, I'll give you, you know, like two soups, give me three soups. And commissary comes back. Exactly. Or whatever it is. You know what I mean? So tell us, you know, because if you're running the yard, there's different hustles. What are some of the, like, you know, crazy things? I just share with you some of my stuff. What are some of the crazy things that are not too crazy that we could share on the air?
Yeah. I mean, when you're running the yard for the, especially the white prisoners, you have to have multiple hustles, you know? So I had groups of youngsters that would do everything for me. You know, I had a group of youngsters that would run in a football parlay with me. Then there'd be a pick all football square. They'd run NASCAR games for me every weekend, slanging drugs on the yard, running
like bookies. You would do betting and stuff.
Oh yeah. I mean, I would have a crew of youngsters just, and each one would have specific things. And I mean, when you're a maximum security, cause you can't even get out of your cell. Like ours is 24-hour day lockdown. Like I had my youngster who would always put my youngster living right next to me. And he would just be my, like literally I'd be a narrator and he'd write kites for me, you know, cause we'd have, that's how you call shots. And Max is just writing a kite. You fish them along the line and literally fish little notes to all the cells. And that's what's called kites. So
I'm about to say, I ain't understanding none of that stuff. Like I got to break that down.
So translate. Okay. What you're saying. I know what you're saying.
So if you're in Max, like Shawshank Redemption,
okay,
it literally looks just like that. Our old Max facility. Right. And if you got a guy that's up on Henry Run, which say is the top run, and I'm all the way down on the other side on Bravo Run, which could be B Run. And you need to get a message to the guy up there. You can't yell. You can't talk, especially if something private. Mm-hmm. What you'll do is I'll write it all on a little piece of paper, fold it up and roll it up as small as I can go. And then I'm going to tie it on the back of a fishing line. And a fishing line, it could be an old shirt, strings from the clothes that you make. And then they literally will wind it up and then fling it out there with a heavy weight on the end until it latches on his bars. And then he pulls the string in with the kite on there. And then I take my line back. It's literally fishing in real life with no water.
Yeah. There's like our PA system, the phone system would be the toilet sometimes. Like when you're in the hole, like you speak through the toilet stuff. Yeah. And people don't understand when I tell them, when you're in ad seg, especially, and you can't come out, like your toilet is your refrigerator. It's your laundry. It's like a multi-purpose. And people were like, how could you do it? I'm like, listen, that was one of the cleanest things there. There's so many people that are super hyper clean, because when you were forced to live like a freaking animal and be creative with the things you could do just so you could have basic necessities that normal people have. I mean, LA is crazy. Question for you.
Oh, they are plotting. Yeah.
I don't know if you got this question a lot, but do you still sometimes, because it's only been 6 years, at 4 o'clock, find yourself looking around, right? Yeah, like for the 4 o'clock count, do you ever just notice it's 4 o'clock?
No, that one, it doesn't. Sometimes if I look at the time and I'll see it, I'm like, oh, it would be counting right now. You know, I don't have like no reminders like that, but for some reason, the 11 o'clock count was always a big one for me.
11? Yeah, 4 o'clock count for me was the normal one. And from what I understood, 4 o'clock count is like across federal and state, you know, facilities. Sometimes counts are different in different facilities, but 4 o'clock count, I believe, is like the standard for stuff.
Yeah. I mean, my biggest one is a 10 to 10. I don't know if they have that back where you're from, but 10 to 10. So a lot of people don't know that. That means from 10 o'clock at night to 10 o'clock in the morning, you don't say a word. So like in maximum security, it is like you can barely hear your TV over your headphones because it's so loud. So 9:59, it is a zoo. And I'm not joking. When it hits 10 o'clock, like you can hear a pin drop in that place. And so that's a lot of what I get now, because by the time I get done, I go to meetings in the morning, I go to the gym. By the time I'm done with my whole morning routine, it's 9:30. So a lot of times by the time I go sit back on my patio in my backyard, I look and it's not even 10 o'clock yet. And that's what I'll think of, like, I wouldn't even be allowed to talk normally right now still. Mm-hmm. I got my whole pretty much routine done for the day already, you know?
Question for you. So what did you learn? I try to explain this to people. Like you learn. See, one thing about prison is that I don't care if you're balling, you're a shot call, you're this or that, you know, again, like regular life, there's a lot of facades, clothes, designer, Gucci, Lamborghinis, all this stuff. When you're in prison, you're stripped down literally and metaphorically to a man, and you are either a bitch and you're going to be treated as such, or you're a man and you're going to be treated as such, or there's going to be consequences. You know what I'm saying? So again, when you're in prison, you learn a lot about respect, in my opinion. Like, you don't reach over people's food. You don't turn around and walk on a man's, like, you know, floor after you just spent, you know, an hour buffing it, or you might get yourself poked up real quick. So I'm just curious, what type of like prison rules or prison politics that you know, you get ingrained after like a decade or 12 years that you're in prison, what type of stuff did you learn in prison that you still have these lessons that you use in day-to-day life, whether it's about respect or about like honor, respect, about reputation or whatever? Explain that to people.
Yeah, I mean, respect is probably the biggest thing. You know, to this day, I don't walk near someone's vicinity without saying, excuse me. If you're looking at something, if you're watching a TV and the TV's 30 feet away and I happen to walk underneath the TV or in front of you, I'm going to say, excuse me, always. And you know what's crazy? A lot of the OGs warned me, because by the time I got out, I was pretty crazy, man. I was a mean, bad dude. And I'm not proud of it, but that's who I was. And they were prepping me, you know, they're like, yo, you're going to have to watch out because people are not respectful like this out here, you know? And that was one thing I was kind of prepped for. So the respect is probably the biggest thing. You know, people are just disrespectful and rude out here, you know, like someone could cut me off in the grocery store. And I was just having this conversation in my driveway right now. And I'm like, cause people are asking me, what's the biggest thing? And I'm like, it's still the people that want to like cut me off at the gas station or anything like that. And I just have to just tell myself, man, it is what it is, you know.
Give these people, for they have no idea what they're doing right now.
I can kind of laugh about it. Yeah, I can laugh about it now. And that's what I literally tell myself. I'm like, you have no idea who I used to be.
Yeah, man. Folks think it's sweet, and it's totally not sweet, right? You should assume that anyone who you cross could be that one. You better watch out.
Against All Odds
is on your radio, ladies and gentlemen.
Did you know that Car.com is a website to connect consumers like you, me, our parents, basically everybody, to local car dealers? Car.com helps us find that perfect vehicle. From new vehicles to certified pre-owned, Car.com will help you find the best vehicle match. Car.com practically started the online car shopping experience. Peace of mind and finding your perfect vehicle, it's what they do. Car.com. We do the research, you do the driving. Get started getting that peace of mind today at Car.com.
Vice TV presents
I Was a Teenage Felon,
Season 2, starring Sean V. Bradley.
He's the king of clubs.
At 19 years old, part of a multi-million dollar international drug ring. Arrested by the Secret Service, DEA.
This was the largest ecstasy case in United States history.
And somehow this dude becomes a best-selling author and a mega millionaire when he gets out of prison.
Find out how, only on Vice TV's I Was a Teenage Felon, Mondays at 10 p.m.
Exclusively on Vice TV.
You know, I like listening to shows like this because you get all types of cool advice on business, parenting, just about everything. But if you're looking for some coaching that applies directly to you, then go to meetwiththemaster.com and book some time on my calendar.
From nothing to everything.
Yo, man, Peter, you are killing it, man. I thank you for saying that because, man, like, I've been out since 1999. So it's been a hot minute I've been out, and I still have flashbacks sometimes. I still am respectful. I'm careful with so many things, but there's so many people I come through on a day-to-day basis. I'm like, yo, you have no idea. There's people that were on death row. Then they did their time and their prison sentence got commuted and they're out in the public. You have no idea how many maximum security violent offenders are amongst us in the population. And people are cutting these people off. They're having their shopping carts crash into their car. They're running by them. Can you imagine rolling up on somebody in the yard, man? Yo, unless you turn around and say, excuse me, or like apologize, whatever, you might get, you know, stuck up. Explain how people like in normal life have no idea how close they are from getting aired out with these people that they have no idea have been in prison and done some real time.
That could be how quick it is too. Cause I'm not joking. I mean, you could be having a conversation and we could be 10 feet apart from each other. And if somebody walks in between us talking, you could literally lose your life over that. And then, because another thing I was schooled to in there, one of the OGs, because once I got to fighting and people knew I was tough, I was like, I thought I could beat everybody up, you know? And then when I started hitting the higher yards, that's what they tell me. They're like, yo, a lot of these dudes in here, they're never going home. They don't even want to, even if they think they can whoop you up, they're not even going to fight just because they don't want to, they're too lazy. And he's like, and that's what I learned. They're like, I'd just rather stab you. There's no chance I'm even going to risk losing a fight. And I'm like, because I was not about that life. You know, that's one thing I always preached in prison. I was no weapons. Everything was with my hands and feet, you know?
Yeah, no, for me, I'm 5'5". I'm not trying to turn around and go against a tough guy or whatever. And that's what Glocks are for, you know what I mean, and straps or whatever. So, yeah, 100%. And I'm sure some of the thorough people that are in that prison that put in work weren't necessarily the cock diesel people. Those are people just their knife game was just off the chain.
Absolutely.
So I get it. And I just wanted to say that out loud here because there's so many people like that just do dumb things and they violate people and have no idea in a different setting, in a different world, they could lose so much, including their life. So now let's now get into this. You're out of jail. You get into the automotive industry. And that's one of the reasons why you're on the show, because I've been in the automotive industry for 23 years now, 22 and a half years. Ooh. And I've been trying to tell people that the automotive industry is one of the most unique situations or careers, because you truly could earn as much money as you can, you know, earn. Yeah, you could make as much money as you can earn, but the key word is earn. I know people that average only 10 cars a month, but I'm chill with people like Cody Carter, who sold 154 cars on the showroom floor at Tustin Toyota.
In 1 month.
Ali Retta, who broke the Guinness Book of World Records, who's going to make $1.4 million selling Chevy and Cadillacs during a pandemic.
In 1 year.
So tell us and tell the world, like, man, how much of a godsend was it getting into the automotive industry? And how did you build up, you know, money and success and be proud that you're not like some like schlep that's on parole and making like, you know, $20,000 a year, you were actually able to do something significant. Talk to us about this.
Yeah. So I went from, I've had one job in my life, you know, and I was selling cars. And so I went from prison my whole life. I feel like I was raised and grew up there, and I finally get a chance to sell cars. And then it's just like, once I got the shot where I can just talk and do my thing and sell. And I was just like, I went from the maximum security yard pretty much, and then out here with no job. So I started making 10 grand a month overnight. And then I'm like, I got my first bonus check, and I was like, what the heck? So then I changed my addiction to that, you know, and then I got into the cars, because I switched my addictions, you know. I got sober before I started selling cars. So like, as long as I've worked is as long as I've been sober, you know. So once I started making money, being sober, being positive, then I was smarter with my money. You know, a lot of even the other guys at the dealership, you know, they'd all be screwing off on the weekends and spending hundreds of dollars on bottle service and doing all this stuff. I was sober. So I always had a nice car. And then I got into, you know, real estate, bought a couple houses, made some money on that. And it's just like, once you've had everything taken from you, you can find so much gratitude in little things. And I can find so much pleasure in just being in my own house on the weekend. You know, I don't need to go out and party and go out till 3 o'clock in the morning and spend $500 on bottle service. You know, I'm at peace watching my big TV that ain't 13 inches in my own house that I paid for with my own car out there, you know? So a lot of people, it's tough for a lot of people to get gratitude when they've never had anything taken from them. That's why it can work to your advantage if you twist that stuff and change your thinking and use it to your advantage.
You know what, man, that's deep, because I feel that way about sight, right? People take that stuff for granted. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? So I totally absolutely come from
gratitude can go for anything, man. I feel like it's the biggest problem in the world to this day is people aren't grateful for anything. Everyone feels like they got the short end of the stick, but nobody wants to do anything to try and change anything. You know
what drives me crazy, being a car guy, and I'd have to rank you if you're F&I as a car guy as well, for all the years you've been into it. Like, there's people that leave the automotive industry and say car sales sucks. I want to slap the dog out of them. LA, you're gonna have to bleep that out later, because I know this is broadcast radio, but I'm really adamant about this, because people that get into the industry and they don't maximize what I have, what you have. I became a multimillionaire because of the automotive industry.
Right, yeah.
And you know, when I see other people that go in and they half-ass it, they put partial energy, they don't maximize, they don't get the OEM certification, they don't go through the training, they don't put any effort in, they just wait for the magic up bus to come through. It blows me away, because look at people like us that have come from horrific, you know, situations and found salvation, found opportunity in the automotive industry. And I look and I'm like, how could you all just piss away this unreal opportunity to make as much money as you could earn? Do you agree with me that there's so many people in our industry in automotive that just don't really like take it seriously, and they don't respect the opportunity they have in front of them?
For sure. That's why it worked so well for me, because all those days I sat in those prison cells just like dreaming of like mowing the lawn or dreaming of anybody to let me do anything, you know? So once I started selling cars, I mean, it's, you can't talk about it, but it made me a couple million bucks in 5 years. I mean, technically I'm semi-retired from the car business after 5 years. And that's why I got to do what I'm doing now and release the podcast and stuff. Cause I want to just help people, you know, but if it wasn't for that, the car business, I mean, I ain't had a paycheck in 6 months. You think I would have been able to do that with anything but the car business?
Exactly. And here's the thing is I'm in a whole different circle with like Brad Lee and Grant Cardone and these guys, and I'm learning so much. And what's crazy is I found that it is harder to get to the gatekeeper, get through the gatekeeper for a car dealer. It's harder to speak to a dealer principal or a GM than it is the freaking CEO of a Fortune 100 500 corporation. So Grant and Brad have said, and I'm going to say this to you, that if you could make it in car sales, man, that is the best. And then I'm going to say this, which Brad and Grant can't talk about. If you've been through prison and you've been through that schooling and you've been through automotive, those two schools or vocational schools have given you so many skills that I'm saying, brother, you could do anything you put your mind to. If you could survive 12 years in prison, max security as a shot caller, if you could turn around and survive 6 years in a dealership, ascend to be an F&I manager and a real estate investor and stuff like that, those skills that got you through the automotive industry and the prison situation, those are skills that you will have for the rest of your life that are going to be able to help you keep growing your business and your brand. So do you agree with what I'm saying or what?
Absolutely. And people don't even know that, you know, that's why, I mean, I have a lot of my friends that went to college, you know, like I went away to prison, they went off to college and had the whole normal life, got good jobs and they got out, you know, and now they reach out to me for advice, you know, and that's why I decided to walk away from my job and do the podcast. You know, I want to
tell us about the podcast. What's the name of your podcast? Tell us about what you're doing, what your speakings, like tell us all the stuff that you're doing. Cause Vice doesn't really give enough time to talk about all the positive stuff that you do. Yeah. And tell me about your wife and your life. Let's hear about all this cool stuff.
Yeah. So I released a podcast. I decided in June that I was going to walk away from my job in I was a finance manager. I made it in finance in just over a year from never even selling a car before. So within a year of selling cars, I had my own office in finance. I had that for about 4 years. And then just this last June, I decided to walk away from my job and I wanted to just release a podcast because I got so many DMs and so many people hit me up everywhere I go, like, how'd you do it? You know what I mean? I don't understand this, you know? And I just want to lay the blueprint out there for people, you know? And I always say everything I got, I'm playing with house money. I shouldn't have anything I have now, you know, but I do have it. And how selfish would it be for me to get to where I am to this day with help from other people, you know, and not pass the message on and not show people that there is hope, you know? And that's my whole podcast is about. It's just inspirational stuff. Some of it's recovery, some of it's just motivational stuff. Everybody can get something from it, whether you're an addict, if you have a family that's addicted, if you don't even have any problems with addiction, you just struggle with mental toughness. I'm laying it all out there for everybody. And it's as real and true and raw as it gets. And it's the same thing I go back when I speak the prisons now, you know, I go speak at, it's another thing we started here. I speak at orientations now. So all the dudes that get out of prison in my county hear from either me or my buddy, where we give them a little speech on telling them how to be successful. You know, I tell them all the same thing. I quit my job to show you guys what's possible. And it's all in my podcast. I'm laying it all out there, you know, and podcast is called Roll Call with Chappy, and it's Chappy. It's on Apple. It's already trending everywhere. And that's my go-to, man. I'm putting everything into this and I just want to help people. I'm not even worrying about money. I know everything is all going to come, and I'm on a bigger mission. That's way bigger than any of us three right here. And I'm just trying to help people. And that's what the podcast is all about.
Tell us about your family, man. I assume that after losing 12 years of your life, that, you know, family and relationships are really important to you. So, you know, kind of brag on your queen right now and how your family life is going and what she thinks of all this stuff and what's your mission for your family going forward.
It's unbelievable, man. You know, I get to, you know, my mom was always the rider with me, visited me every weekend, no matter how far away I was, as long as I had a visit, she could visit. She always visited me, you know, and now she gets to live with me rent free, doesn't have to pay rent. I mean, I don't ever let her pay for anything anywhere we go. You know, it's like, it feels good to come full circle and be able to like treat the people that are wrong for so many years, you know? And the wife's the same way, you know, she's the same for dealing with me, you know, because a lot of times I still think I'm a shot caller, you know, and I realize it's not about that. And I was at lunch just talking about this right now, you know, like it's something I work on daily, because in prison, you know, if I don't care if it's sunny out and I told you it's cloudy, you're going to agree with me and say it's cloudy or else, you know, and I can't just force that on people out here. You know, I have to think about her feelings and it's not just me anymore, you know, and it's not about who's tough. And if someone doesn't like what I say, then I can go beat them up. It ain't about that. It's about just like being a fulfilled person and like caring about other people and thinking about not just me, but what she wants in life, you know, and what my mom wants in life, my brother. And I just try to be so right because I was so wrong for so many years, you know.
And
there's nothing more fulfilling than helping people now, you know. And that's one thing I noticed. I do a lot of charity work now, you know. And one thing I'll tell you, if people don't get out there and help people, it is the greatest feeling in the world. Because if you're dealing with some bad stuff and you got some stuff in your head or something like that, you go out and help people for a day and you see people that got real problems. For one, you can see that you're going to get some gratitude because you don't have it as bad as the other person. And two, it just takes you out of your own head. You don't even think about the stuff that's in your head because you're watching some other cool stuff. And then you're like, and then you can have empathy for these people because you can actually really feel it for yourself. You know, that's what the one thing, the biggest thing I preached now is, if you ain't ever gone out there and try to help somebody, go help people. You know, that's what I did last Christmas. And that's how I got tied in with Sheriff Lamb. You know, I started making some real money, you know, I was just like, I just want to give back and help people, you know, because I took my whole life. So last Christmas, I decided to sponsor some families, some single mothers with Sheriff Lamb. And to this day, me and Sheriff Lamb are good friends, you know, and it's kind of unreal that I can have.
No, that is absolutely incredible. And Peter, I'm really excited to have you, you know, be part of this Vice TV season 2 finale. We're doing this big premiere for the finale in Philadelphia on November 22nd. You're going to be flying in from the West Coast.
First time ever.
Yeah, oh, really? That's awesome. And then you're going to be able to connect with Seth Ferrante, who was the season finale for season 1. There'll be, you know, the couple people from my crew that co-stars are going to be there. And it's going to be a red carpet event. You're bringing your wife, of course, right?
Yeah, me, you, and Seth are going to hang out. I think we're just going to let the wives hang out.
Yeah. No, we're going to have a lot of fun and stuff like that. And then there's a possibility that you might actually be, you know, at the IS20G in the automotive industry back in Philadelphia. So, man, listen, it's been an honor. And, man, yo, L.A., what you think?
Yo, man, phenomenal show. And, Peter, man, excellent stuff.
Thank y'all.
Thanks for being on. Against All Odds. The podcast is...
Roll call with Chappie.
Make sure you check it out.
Hey, world, this is Sean V. Bradley, and if you need to buy a new or pre-owned car and want to have the best, most convenient experience ever, get full transparency, the absolute lowest price, no stress, best customer service, well, I highly recommend Car.com.
Vice TV presents
I Was a Teenage Felon,
Season 2, starring Sean V. Bradley.
He's the king of clubs.
At 19 years old, part of a multi-million dollar international drug ring. Arrested by the Secret Service, DEA.
This was the largest ecstasy case in United States history.
And somehow this dude becomes a best-selling author and a mega millionaire when he gets out of prison.
Find out how only on Vice TV's I Was a Teenage Felon, Mondays at 10 p.m.
Exclusively on Vice TV.
Did you know that Car.com is a website to connect consumers like you, me, our parents, basically everybody, to local car dealers? Car.com helps us find that perfect vehicle. From new vehicles to certified pre-owned, Car.com will help you find the best vehicle match. Car.com practically started the online car shopping experience. Peace of mind and finding your perfect vehicle, it's what they do. Car.com, we do the research, you do the driving. Get started getting that peace of mind today at Car.com.
You're listening to WORK Radio. The only place success comes before work is in the dictionary.
The Against All Odds radio show comes to you every week from the city of brotherly love, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. If you have a question about the show or would like the chance to become a guest and share your success story, we would love to talk to you. You can reach us directly at 856-546-2440 or email us at AgainstAllOddsRadioShow@gmail.com. This program is a presentation of Synergy Records, streaming live coast to coast and downloadable everywhere podcasts are found. The Against All Odds Radio Show is produced by Sean V. Bradley, CSP. Production and engineering by L.A. Williams. The Against All Odds Radio Show is hosted every week by L.A. Williams and the millionaire car salesman himself, Mr. Sean V. Bradley, CSP. Plus, don't forget Sean's best-selling book, Win the Game of Googleopoly, is available right now on Amazon. Thanks for listening to the Against All Odds radio show, and remember, where I come from, money provides options. The Against All Odds radio show is sponsored in part by Scarfood, Car.com, and Dealer Synergy.